This is Mark Lieberman, the host of the show, The World According to Mark. Today, we're going to talk about what's happening with our First Amendment rights in the United States today. I think that most of us realize that we're in a fairly fraught time in which challenges to First Amendment rights, restrictions in First Amendment rights are prominent in the lead up to the presidential election and front and center in a lot of cases that the ex-president is involved in. So I had just completed teaching a course at UNCA for the seniors program, which was a 6-week course in which we went into detail about what the First Amendment is, how it came to be included in the Bill of Rights as part of the Constitution, and discussing what are common misconceptions about the First Amendment, and frankly, real significant uncertainty at all levels about what's part of the global rights on freedom of expression and what isn't. So I've titled this podcast, Lies, Misinformation, Fake News, Conspiracy Theories, and the First Amendment. Basically, I want to start out with acknowledging that everybody lies. Presidents lie, politicians lie, news personalities lie, the clergy lies. And despite the fact that lying is pervasive, especially by people who use lying to further their political aspirations or their financial benefits or their prestige and popularity, and even we who post things on the internet, lies are still a problem. It's really been recognized for a long time that lies in terms of public discourse are corrosive in many ways to the social fabric, and they're corrosive to foundational issues that were articulated in our founding documents, the Declaration of Independence and the First Amendment. Lies hobble us in many ways. It makes people unable to accept or understand reality, and attempts that we have constantly tried to make in the republic, this democratic republic, to secure social and moral progress. But those who've studied this, which include many scholars and lawyers and jurists, have concluded time and time again that lies are generally protected from government intrusion by the First Amendment. So let's just challenge that for a moment, or at least let's look into what that means. What does the First Amendment actually say about misinformation and lies and the limits of First Amendment protection? Well, the answer, understandably enough, is it really says nothing about that. There may be other parts of, there are other parts of the Constitution that deal with things like treason, which is rarely used as a weapon in, with respect to curtailing speech and freedoms of the press. The text of the First Amendment is fairly simple. It's only, 46 words. The text says, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, or abridging freedom of speech or of the press, or the right of the people to peaceably assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances. Now, there were earlier versions of the First Amendment which expressed things in a more affirmative way, But this is what was ultimately included in the Bill of Rights, and it continues, of course, to this day. Let's break this down a bit. First of all, First Amendment covers more than just speech. There are at least five separate components. First of all, there's a right to be free of politically imposed religious orthodoxy, as was widespread in Europe when this country broke from Europe. And that concept has persisted for the most part without interruption to this day, although there's changes being made in that sector. The right to worship, or impliedly the right not to worship, the right of free speech and free press, right to assemble with like-minded citizens or assemble in general to peaceably talk about and express points of view. And then one that's not often mentioned, but the right to petition the government to address grievances, meaning the government can't tell citizens that they need to shut up and not complain about its policies and laws. Government has to be open to a direct route for individuals to express concerns and criticisms, and including, of course, filing a lawsuit or talking to their congressperson or whatever. So what do these words mean? Unless we're going to focus again primarily on speech and press and assembly. What is the principal thing we can take away from this in terms of understanding how it should be applied? Well, the first thing to recognize is that the First Amendment with respect to free speech and free press only deals with the government. It says explicitly Congress shall make no law respecting a number of things, including the free exercise of press and speech. So if the government is not involved, the First Amendment protection of speech and press doesn't apply. Doesn't apply to private discussions or discussions among neighbors or discussion with companies or with your employer. It doesn't apply, obviously, to international transactions per se. And as a corollary to that, private companies, whether they be platforms like Google and Facebook and Twitter and TikTok, which has been in the news of late, those companies in effect have their own freedom of speech freedoms. And they cannot, or thus far, even though Congress is consistently recently been trying to figure out ways to do more or less benign restrictions or some restrictions or qualified restrictions in terms of ownership of these platforms and so on and so forth, those social media platforms and outlets have freedom of speech in their own right, and the individuals who put things on the platforms, I realize my words are a bit archaic when we're talking about platforms, but who post and go viral and, you know, repost and retweet and so on and so forth, those individuals have rights as well, but they have those rights as against government intervention, not intervention by the government, because the government is what the First Amendment was seeking to prohibit from involving itself directly in free speech by the population at large. Now, how has the First Amendment, with its supposedly broad application, at least to actions by the government? Well, first of all, I want to note that the First Amendment, as drafted and as adopted as an amendment to the Constitution originally, only had application to the federal government not abridging freedom of speech, not passing laws or enforcing laws. And it wasn't until many years later, with the passage of the 14th Amendment, which includes a lot of different provisions on equal protection under the law, and then the application of the 14th Amendment to the First Amendment, which occurred again years after that, that there was application to the states. By states, I mean state government, city government, county government, local government. So anything that the First Amendment applied to with respect to government intervention, and they use the word Congress, after years and years, the First Amendment has now been considered undoubtedly to apply to outlaw or prohibit state and local governments from from restrictions on the First Amendment, except with some narrow exceptions, which I hope we can get to in a few minutes. So let's again talk about some obvious exceptions, even if the government is involved in trying to introduce a restriction. Speech that incites imminent danger still and for some time has been considered an exception, to the protection of the First Amendment, which means that there are certain things that go beyond simply standing on a soapbox or putting a placard on a telephone pole, that the government can decide not to tolerate. Most of us who understand or have heard or still think it applies the analogy to yelling fire in a crowded theater, which was first articulated in an opinion of the Supreme Court. And what the justice who spoke about yelling fire in a crowded theater was trying to say is, you know, we're going to protect free speech, and we're going to protect people's right to say things that might even be hateful, odious, dangerous. But if, and we're going to do that if it's more rhetorical than it is a command to specifically do violence, to burn something, to maim somebody, to kill somebody, to take physical action. But that, it turns out that analogy doesn't work really well in real life. And you know, one of the examples in which it seems to still be contested is in one of the many charges against Trump, both politically and in the courts, is that accusing him of inciting the riots on January 6th at the Capitol. I struggled for a minute there because some people call it a riot. Some people call it an attempt to overthrow the government. Some people who say it wasn't much of anything said it was just people reasonably exercising their right of free speech. But those issues are still front and center in terms of the discourse, in terms of civil and criminal actions. And so we're not really sure what the limits are. Well, I mean, I think in the extremes, we're sure what they are. If you're standing next to a person that you abhor and would like to erase from the earth, and you don't pull out a gun or do anything to hurt, injure, or prevent that person from talking directly, and you just simply say, you know, you ought to be buried 6 feet under or something like that. And it's just it's an atrocious comment, it's an odious comment, but that comment itself is probably going to get First Amendment protection. But if you're standing next to somebody who has the means to inflict harm or to kill another person, and you say, go kill that person now, that would not be protected under virtually any additional circumstances that you can postulate. But again, there's a big chasm between somebody who actively gets involved in planning an insurrection, which is what many people refer to as the January 6th affair, and who figure out ways to get people together, who can take baseball bats, guns, knives, whatever, and to assault the Capitol, and to do that in particular to change a political outcome, which is what people talk about and what Trump is under indictment for, the ex-president. Those what are seemingly attacks on institutions, and seemingly are where speech and conduct are together. One follows the other, or it's done in tandem. The government has shown that it can indict and possibly convict individuals who couple their speech with action. So if you go up to a building that is a government building or any building, and you seek to gain entrance, and you use a crowbar to break a window, and you go through a guard or a law enforcement officer, and you push that person to the ground, you don't need to worry about whether or not we don't need to worry about whether that person's actions would be protected by the First Amendment, because that conduct itself, there are many ways in which conduct like that can be restricted, charged, penalized, and so on and so forth, because it's coupled with conduct which is otherwise unlawful. Now, what's happening beyond those types of issues today is that people are still saying that their First Amendment rights need to have greater leverage, that they need to exercise their freedom of speech, even if they are saying things that are hateful, that are racist, that are lies, that are misinformation or disinformation. And that, again, runs into this First Amendment as sort of a barrier, because the Constitution, the First Amendment, does not differentiate between speech that is objective, or that speech is which is a true, from speech which is a lie. So hate speech comes up over and over again, and it has come up more frequently in the last several years during what some people call the Trump era, but it doesn't matter if you create a name for it. It wasn't invented by Donald Trump. In this country, in the United States, what I would refer to as pure hate speech, you can't use the First Amendment as a way of saying, you can't say that hate speech falls outside, maybe more clear, outside of the First Amendment. Now I'm going to pause again and reintroduce this topic, because we're going to talk about specific limits, specific limits that people think exist in terms of the First Amendment that also include actions. So over from the middle of the 20th century, Supreme Court, which is the arbiter ultimately of what falls inside or what falls outside the First Amendment, have come down with case decisions that you wouldn't necessarily think is consistent with the rights and protections of the First Amendment. For example, flags can be burned in protest. It wasn't thought to be that way all of the time or since the birth of this nation during riots over the Vietnam War and other previous military interventions that the United States was involved with, or people would burn flags and police would come in and for that action alone would feel they could arrest a person for violating the law. The Supreme Court says you can't do that. Somebody burns a flag as a way of symbolizing their freedom of speech and their protest about a certain policy issue. We can't regulate that. Does that mean you can go on to a private person's property, pull the flag off the holder and burn it in that person's front yard? No, because you're trespassing, you're interfering with private property. The individual who's using the flag is expressing their speech, but you cannot prevent them from doing that. In fact, again, there are laws on trespass, there are laws of putting people in danger that are going to be considered okay to counter that kind of action. But beyond that, we've had instances and continue to have instances in this country where neo-Nazis, sometimes called skinheads, whatever they're called, who use swastikas and other Nazi paraphernalia in parades and in demonstrations. And the question is, can that be prevented, or can the activities of that group be prevented because they're using speech that promotes racism and promotes anti-Semitism, and they wave flags? Generally, no. Cities and counties have some limited rights in terms of regulating when and where those protests can occur, but they can't use those laws in a way which prevents the individuals who hold those hateful, odious views can would be prevented from expressing themselves. And this goes all the way back to the ACLU's representation of neo-Nazis who wanted to get a permit in order to specifically march in an area which was known to have Jewish survivors of the Holocaust and other families. And the ACLU defended them, and ultimately the courts ruled that a permit could not be denied. We've also had issues involving civil rights. We've had restrictions even to this day on, or at least controversies as to what can be done on campus, college campuses, specifically public college campuses. What can be done to prevent somebody from speaking? What can be done to prohibit a crisis that possibly could erupt into violence? And the point I'm making is that unless the state or local government can prove that those activities will cause imminent lawlessness, behavior and actions that would result in that, those protests, even if they're loud and people say inflammatory things, have largely been protected again by First Amendment. Now, I want to also say that the protections of the First Amendment have sometimes been used by the government in ways which have proven over time to clearly be unconstitutional because of the First Amendment. So going back to John Adams' administration, he was a Federalist. He was concerned about the possibilities of war with Britain and wanted to reach out to France. And a lot of people were protesting that and saying bad things about John Adams and bad things about the administration and so on and so forth. So what did Adams do? He instituted or helped push forward what's referred to as the Alien and Sedition Acts collectively, in order to put people in jail, essentially, just because they spoke up about their distaste and distrust of the government. And for several years, those laws were still in place until the Supreme Court struck them down, or until they were repealed, or died a quick death. And that type of intervention by the government has persisted in, did persist in other wars, and even in situations where there was not an active shooting war going on, but there was a concern about the war. So World War I had its own version of the Alien and Sedition Act. Sometimes they were referred to as the Espionage Act. World War II, the same thing. After World War II and during the period that's been described as the Cold War and the Vietnam War, and in the aftermath of 9/11, laws were put on the books to say, we can't let people express their views, even if it is, you might say it's part of their freedom of speech, if it puts the government and the fabric of the government in jeopardy. And frankly, time and time again, those laws were contested, and in most every case, they were delegitimized. Even the efforts that were made after 9/11 with ways of tracking individuals and maintaining that they were engaged in treason and they were trading information with the enemy and so on and so forth, which are hard burdens to basically be able to carry, these laws keep coming up. So there's a thought that, okay, freedom of speech, First Amendment protects rights, except if what somebody is saying or doing threatens the security of the United States. And I'm simply saying that while those types of protests and those types of government threats, like, you know, the ex-president said we should, you know, we should quell protests by relying on the laws that prohibit insurrections. We should institute martial law. Well, you can say that that's what you want to do, but if you take the steps to pull people off the streets, throw them in jail, you know, do things that use dogs and bats and so on and so forth, that is most likely to be reversed, and the persons responsible, that some actions are generally taken to prevent that. So the balance is there to balance obvious imminent threats, but even in cases where people protest the war, they protest the loss of civil liberties, First Amendment likely is going to be used to immunize the proponents of free speech and the active protesters, and make the government have to back off. Now, where are we today? And again, I'm saying today in terms of what have we seen over the last few years, and what are we seeing in the lead up to the 2024 election, and what do we think might happen after that, depending upon who's becomes the president and who are the figures in Congress. I think there's a legitimate concern about the resilience of the First Amendment. And there's a concern about maybe the First Amendment is inadequate to the problems that we're experiencing today because of the mass media, because of hundreds of different ways in which people can address their concerns and thoughts and say bad things and repost and retweet and go around the globe. What's all that about? I mean, we hear things like conservatives are intolerant about liberals. Who liberals are? I'm not going to try to touch on that subject. Their use of so-called cancel culture or attacks on big tech and social media platforms by persons who have been taken off those platforms. Again, oftentimes right-wing politicians and public intellectuals. Those issues are not, again, brand new. It's just that the way in which everybody, without a printing press, without a radio spot or a podcast, they can promote ideas that they think are correct, but other people might say that's untrue or you're misleading or it's a conspiracy theory and so on and so forth. And how do we address that? We can address it legally, but trying to address it legally runs into, again, some very strong precedent about the reach of the First Amendment. And many have argued that we're not really talking about the law. We're talking about cultural issues. We're talking about dialogue, social dialogue. We don't need to call the government in to introduce new laws or to intervene. People just have to be more civil. Companies have to encourage and figure out ways to disincent that kind of expression of viewpoints. Unions are allowed to do certain things in order to get a collective bargaining agreement for the benefit of the employees. There are state laws that regulate the extent to which persons who are not part of a union have responsibility for paying for union activity. But by and large, although there's always seems to be something whenever a union pops up, in which management, obviously wanting to discourage unionization, tries to take steps to discourage the promotion of those ideas. And then we have the unions who are sometimes fighting back, most of the time without violence, but ways in which management feels that those activities should not discourage individuals from doing what they're supposed to do as employees of the company. There are lots of calls to try to define hate speech in a way that doesn't necessarily just include conduct, and promoting the idea that hate speech per se, one that, you know, criticizes individuals because of their ethnicity or their color or their religion or their gender preferences, and calls to have the government somehow set some limits as to what can and cannot be protected and what kinds of speech could be prevented because it's speech that has, quote, little value. But as much as individuals on both sides of the right and left political divide, and even in the middle, nobody seems to have come up with a magic solution. And part of that is because, you know, many people say we don't care what you're saying. We consider what you're saying to be offensive, and we don't want you expressing your points of view. And you know, that goes back to another I mentioned, yelling fire at a crowded theater. So going back to philosophers from France and England and into the 19th and 20th centuries in this country, many people use the expression or the statement, I may disagree with your statements and your point of view, but I'll fight to the death your right to express those. Well, would that that was, you know, actually what is required in terms of legal requirements. That may be, you know, a good concept that I can make a differentiation between what you're saying and my disagreement with it, including my strong disagreement. But you get to say that because that's why we have a constitution. That's why we have a democracy. That's what the founders were saying. Well, individuals throughout time, from the civil rights movement, Martin Luther King, Thurgood Marshall, who was a justice on the Supreme Court, have basically said, you can't draw these hard distinctions between the speech that you think should be protected and speech that you don't think is protected. And they've gone so far in most cases to say that rather than having the government step in and put in place laws that individuals have to obey or try to regulate social media in a certain way, one of the benefits, key advantages of the First Amendment is you can counter the speech that you disagree with by expressing speech that you think has a better shot of convincing people to do the right thing or to follow your viewpoint. So the process of having freedom of speech, freedom of press, freedom of expression, the ability to freely demonstrate subject to certain narrow exceptions, that's how these issues get solved. You encourage people to listen, and then if they oppose, to bring out countervailing theories. So if an ex-president or future president takes the position that the last election was a fraud and that the election was stolen, which is an interesting term, one might not think that that really is an applicable term, even if you're talking about some number of individuals who shouldn't have been allowed to vote, so on and so forth. But the extent to which that kind of argument is propelled through social media, through public rallies, through letters to the editor, doesn't preclude and should incent people who have other facts, who have facts to support that the election wasn't stolen, that yes, there was a degree of fraud, but it was insignificant in terms of the totality of information that was available. And sometimes while the squeaky wheel gets the oil, or to put it in a way that's more apropos to what we're talking about, the news media will cover a particular event, a MAGA event, or a left-wing extremist event in which extreme points of view are articulated. Those ways of expressing different viewpoints is what helps to sort things out. And then, just to put that a finer point on it is, yes, there's lots of battlegrounds that are available now and freely available for individuals to find out information, to hear different points of view, and also to hear what seems to be extremely biased points of view or points of view that lack credibility or lack factual support. But the advantage to having lots of media that is not put out by the government is that you can educate yourself. You can make decisions about what press or what journalism seems to resonate with your sense of things. And you can, again, obviously, and probably should read the opposite points of view and come to your own conclusions. And then instead of necessarily trying to change the minds of people that seem entrenched with their own beliefs, you gather together through the internet or in other ways, more personal ways, and have discussions to promote your point of view or points of view that you resonate with. That again is what democracy anticipated, and that is still, quote, the best way of doing things. And again, that's a point of view, but people legitimately argue that, well, that doesn't work too well today because the battle line, so to speak, between the right and the left are asymmetrical, that we have a system in this country where states can make decisions and draw maps about who gets to vote in what precinct and so on and so forth. And we've all heard the term gerrymandering, which has been done for eons, essentially, in this country, where electoral places are determined in a way that benefits one of the two principal political parties, the Republicans or the Democrats. And at this point in 2021, and for some time before that, it appears that the Republicans have been able to stake a substantial majority in the majority of state houses across the country. And it's those states that have been passing laws that curtail certain curriculum being taught in the schools, that have assisted in promoting the banning of books that express certain points of view, that have been able to raise money to put out the word to get more people involved in even lower echelons of government, like school boards and county boards and city councils and so on and so forth, to leverage the ideas that the advocates of those positions ascribe to. And the more left-wing liberal organizations, while they certainly do their share, they seem not to have in many cases the same political clout. And so long as states can pass laws that are potentially subject to attack and have been attacked and are working their way through the court system regarding books that can be banned or curriculum that can't be taught in public school, particularly lower grades, not just dealing with obscenity, which is typically something that government can restrict, and particularly for lower grades in schools, primarily in public schools, those circumstances are not irreversible. But they're reversible to the extent that new representatives are elected who express points of view that are more tolerated by people who call themselves progressive, liberals, leftists, independents, moderate Republicans, and so on and so forth. And that is the way that a democracy is supposed to function. And that's how people get to change restrictions and prevent, even in the first instance, from some of these laws that are they're political in nature. The idea of, for example, banning books about the Holocaust or books that discuss the roots of slavery in the United States and throughout the world, or ways in which women have been discriminated against for years, even after their rights to vote and so on and so forth have been sustained. You can make a better case for not getting into some of that more politically tinged content in lower grades because of the lack of capacity and maturity for younger students to discern what's right and what's wrong and so on and so forth. But again, even with that, probably not a very good case because, you know, things about social justice and ethics and history, there's a lot, it's fact-based. It's hard to say that slavery wasn't a bad thing and that the remnants of slavery still exist. There can be useful debates about whether discrimination and racial inequality is, quote, systemic. I'm not sure what that even really, that word is even doing in political discussions. You can talk about it as a disease. But as you move up the ladder, including into a university level, it's hard to find any justification for those kinds of restrictions because students who get, you know, learn that what they need to learn in grammar school, which used to be called grammar school, I'm showing my age, you know, reading, writing, and arithmetic, they're ultimately needing to get the benefits of a full education that includes what some people call civics. I'll just say it's government and history and the history of conflicts and the history of discrimination, as well as, you know, the good things. But people need to be trusted. And that's, again, I think that's fundamental to the US Constitution. It's fundamental to the original Bill of Rights that include the First Amendment, the rights of free speech and free press and freedom of assembly. And I think that denying access or putting books that describe these things in detail on a higher shelf somewhere in a library that nobody can get at, I think that does a disservice. I mean, people, first of all, people are using other social media anyhow, don't go to the library necessarily and pick up, you know, books. But we as a society need to make ourselves more accepting of points of view that we don't agree with. And those who would say, no, this goes too far. I'm a parent. I'm putting my kid through school. I don't want my kid to be exposed to all this stuff. We don't teach that at home. You know, there are ways in which parents can deal with those issues. And some of those ways are also not necessarily helpful. If you pull all kids out of public, free public school and give people opportunities to homeschool, well, I understand the benefits associated with it. And you sort of keep them in a bubble and they're only exposed to what you as parents want to tell them. Ultimately, I think that's a failing way of doing things. It's a failing prospect. So let's talk now again about ways in which you, the listening audience here, using, you know, various media that you may be hearing or seeing the show, Apple, Spotify, Google, radio networks that are affiliated with Pacifica, YouTube. Let's talk about what people think are speech that still needs some kind of restriction, even though I've explained why that's very difficult to do. Racist speech, you know, racism is a bad thing. When racism is the motivator for keeping people out of public establishments, keeping people out of restaurants or organizations or whatever, it's a hateful thing. It's a bad thing. And in some cases, that alone, because of civil rights advancements, can be protected, but not the speech itself. What about lies? And more importantly, what about misinformation by politicians, which is sort of the same as a lie, but, you know, there's something that has been called a white lie for years and years, but a lie is a lie. Shouldn't that be restricted? Because politicians, presidents, senators, governors, they hold a lot of power. There's this thing that's been described as the bully pulpit. Well, I don't know what that means exactly. I mean, I sort of know how it got its roots. But what we're saying is, if a politician is vying for an important public office, and citizens who are trying to make an independent decision about who to vote for and what law, what policies that they want to be front and center, why can't we call out politicians who are saying things that are not credible or that are not supported by an authoritative body of fact? Well, you can do that, but can we restrict it by the government? That's the thing that we're talking about. And I'm saying that the leading thoughts articulated by people who've been trying to figure this out for decades is there's no good way if you let the government make those decisions, if you give the government the power. There's religious information that is coming into what some people refer to as Christian nationalism and other points of view that are expressed about, you know, God shed his grace on the United States and Christianity was the foundation for this country. And there should be more, not only respect for religions, but religion should be a fundamental tenet. Well, you know, we have the First Amendment, as I said, it provides that there shall be no establishment of religion and people ought to be able to freely exercise. Well, the whole establishment issue is a whole other issue. Some people have said for years that the non-establishment clause of the First Amendment means that there should be a wall of separation between the government and religious organizations. Well, again, these words like this get thrown around all the time. They don't necessarily solve the problem. But one thing we know is this country broke from England and they broke from a state religion or country religion. And people that settled this country came from different religious faiths. And many were persecuted in their home countries because they held to a particular faith. What we don't want to do is we don't want to return to those days and make people feel that they owe a separate obligation in terms of what they decide they're going to do in government circles to their own religion. That seems to me to be out of bounds. I talked about the banning of books and videos. You know, not really a good idea. Some things should be deemed restricted in terms of how it's used, depending upon age and maturity. Now, I want to talk about another issue, which is coming up more frequently. The Supreme Court is trying to deal with a issue about whether the government should get involved in specific social network, and they're attacking an entity or a platform called Twitter. But the way they're attacking it is they're saying that Twitter is being controlled by a China, a country who is generally deemed to be an enemy or at least hostile to the United States, although we're buying millions and millions and millions of dollars worth of goods from them and they're buying stuff from us. But along with that is this idea about where do things go? It's hard enough trying to figure out what should and shouldn't be done in social media, but what about artificial intelligence? So many people have extolled the benefits of artificial intelligence, how it's already helping us in various ways. It's taking simple jobs that are being done by individuals that cost lots of money and making them be able to be done through not just robotics, but basically using the concept of algorithms and artificial intelligence to do things that were done specifically with human intervention, human oversight. Well, we don't have time in this discussion to talk of all the permutations about artificial intelligence, but I do want to speak to the issue of whether or not artificial intelligence, as it's woven its way and continues to weave its way into freedom of speech, freedom of expression, changing pictures, digital images, and lots of concern about fake pictures or pictures that have been altered, or taking a video of a president or an ex-president and making a video which would be very difficult to determine that the individual who looks like an actor or a president or senator is not speaking those words and speaking them either in a self-promotional way or in a hateful way against a political rival. And we have to live with the fact that artificial intelligence is not only a reality, but it's going to be used more and more often. It is going to become even more sophisticated. It's going to be more ubiquitous. It means lots of people that are employed to do things and to supervise things and to get involved in things are going to be using it. Does the First Amendment, does it protect artificial intelligence? Well, the short answer is the First Amendment applies to people or corporations who are deemed in some regards to be people or representatives of people. It does not apply to technologies. So as realistic as an artificial intelligence algorithm might be, or the result of using that algorithm, if an article is created through using artificial intelligence like ChatGPT and a few others that I could rattle off, the government cannot protect, essentially, First Amendment doesn't protect the artificial intelligence, but that's kind of like a sort of a non sequitur. Whoever created the artificial intelligence, that's probably freedom of expression by creating a technology. But the product of an artificial intelligence product, such as, again, an article or an advertisement or a video, it's going to be pretty tricky for the government to basically discourage the use of artificial intelligence, although there are efforts being made to do just that. And the basis for doing that is going to ultimately have to be a tailored response based upon some compelling governmental purpose. And it needs to, whoever is going to say that that AI product should be prohibited, or that the platform on which it's being used should be prohibited, there's going to have to be an evaluation at some level that the prohibition or the restriction is more important than the free expression itself, because there's an underlying social value or threat to society that that AI piece is actually doing. The government, whoever is going to assail that, is going to have to basically make that case before a judge and so on, before a judge and jury, whatever. So those are long-term challenges, but unfortunately, or fortunately or unfortunately, AI is here. There are all kinds of, they call generative artificial intelligence tools that can write essays, design images, edit movies, restrict not letting film companies introduce individuals who look like human beings, but who are actually images that are created. And those features that are the purpose of AI, the practicality of using AI, people on both sides are going to argue the benefit, and efforts that people might want to make to curtail that are going to have to pass very stringent debate about what's the end result? What does this do? And again, I think that there are benefits and there are obvious dangers But the same thing has been true in this discussion. First Amendment has benefits to people who want to express themselves, and it has detriments to people who are concerned about it, don't want it, think that it's illiberal and that it goes against our traditions. But those are ultimately not legal arguments. So we're living in a framework of law, and those decisions ultimately are going to have to pass a lot of legal standards. So I want to thank you, those of you who are watching this on Facebook or YouTube, and those of you that are hearing this broadcast on a Pacifica network. We will talk more about these and other issues in future podcasts.